There we go. Okay, it's Friday, June 23rd, 2017, and I'm speaking with Bob Evans.
That's right.
E-V-A-N-S?
Right.
Okay. What's your birth date, Bob?
My birthday is April the 19th. I was born in 1928, so that tells you how old I am.
So you'll be...
I'll be 90 next
year. Yeah. Where were you born?
A little place called Bracken, Saskatchewan, down near the U.S. border, straight south of Swift Current, if you, as the crow flies, yeah. And the dry part of Saskatchewan.
Were you born into a farm family?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. My dad was was one of the first people to apply for a homestead there in that particular part. It was filling up, that's backing away in the early 1909 they opened it up.
And so was that 160 acres?
To start with, yeah.
Yeah.
And you had to prove up on that. I think it was 10 acres a year you had to plow up and show you'd done something anyway. And for 3 years, and after that, you've got the preemption of the other 160 next to it, and had to prove up on that as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he'd been there in 1909, and was he there on his own or married?
No, he was on his own. He didn't marry my mother until 1927.
Oh, just before you were born?
Yes, I was born the next year.
Right, so. And were you the first of a number of kids?
No, just my sister and I. She was born 18 months after I was born.
And her name is?
Well, her name was Noel Ruth Evans, and she became Noel Plant. She married a local boy, yep. Dwayne.
So you grew up with farming in your blood?
Yeah, I guess you might say, yeah. And that was back in the 30s I grew up, and I guess you know all about the Depression, yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't live in Brecon, Saskatchewan in the Depression.
No.
What was that like?
Oh, as I recall, you know, when you're kids, you don't... We knew that my dad had very little money and stuff like that, you know, and still he made deals with mortgage companies for another half section of land and crop share thing. Well, the crops sometimes were only 10 bushel or something like that to the acre, and very dry part.
How did you guys survive?
Actually, like everybody else that was there, mind you, it thinned out too. A lot of the original people left, but it gradually thinned out, and we had cows, we had chickens, we had pigs, when you had a bit of grain, you took it into the flour mill and got them to mill you up 100 pounds of flour, things like that, yeah.
And was your mom a good homemaker there to kind of keep you guys going?
My mother was a city girl. She grew up in Victoria, and she became a stenographer, and she worked her way out. She was a stenographer for a big co-op, fruit co-op in southern BC to start with. She ended up at Shaunavon, Saskatchewan, which was the nearest town when my dad homesteaded there. And that's where he met her, I guess. And you know, you don't ask your parents all these little details until way afterwards when you should have. Yeah.
But she, as a farm homemaker, how did she do?
Yes, she did fine, yeah. She in some ways didn't fit in with some of the community, but because the fact that she was a city girl, but she spent her whole life there.
Wow.
Yeah, when my dad passed away in 57, we went a couple of years, just myself and her. I wasn't married yet. And she took off. She was going to take a month off and go back to Victoria and spend some time. She had a couple of friends there yet. She spent a week there, and she couldn't stand the fact that there was no sunlight. She'd been out in the prairies where the sun shone every day, you know, pretty well. Then she went over to Seattle, where her brother, my uncle, lived, and she spent a week there and came home. She couldn't stand it there either. The foggy winter weather. She said the sun only shone for a couple of hours one day all the time she was there. And she grew up in that, you know.
But she got so used to Brecon and the sunshine that and having a home there.
You lived there, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you farmed there by yourself with your mom.
Yeah, after my dad passed away. I farmed with my dad to start with.
Right.
We didn't have a lot of land or anything, but... And, yeah. And when my dad passed away, we'd started to pick up some other... A quarter here and a quarter there.
So how large did your farm grow to become?
When we sold out in 1974, we had 17 quarters altogether.
Wow.
And we were probably looking for more, except I was married by that time. I married in 68, and we had two little girls that were ready for school, and that's why we moved to Alberta, because our schools were disappearing, more people were leaving all the time. They settled the whole area at one time, and it just gradually went to nothing. Partly because of the all things changed too, you know.
So you left the farm in 70.
We came here in 75.
Five.
We sold it in 74.
What brought you here?
The foothills of Alberta. Yeah, and I'm making this a terrible long story.
That's okay. I'm interested.
When we came here, we went around my wife's sister and her brother-in-law were already in Calgary. They had sold their farm too, and we went around in continuing wider circles around Calgary for 3 days. And third time out, we stopped in Nanton, and I had an acreage on the across from the Esso station. There's a Quonset back in the field. We still own most of that, and they wanted a lot of money for it, almost a quarter of what we sold the farm for. But anyway, that's beside the point. We had got into some purebred Simmental cattle, and we brought those with us, and there was 90 acres there, and we were going to thin them down anyway, and it was part of it was hay and part of it was pasture. It was kind of ideal.
And this land over here?
Yeah, you know where the North Esso station is when you come from the north. It's right across 26th Avenue. There's a house with a brick front on it and whatever. We built that later on, and the Quonset back in the field. My daughter and son-in-law and family live in that now. We subdivided off 3.7 acres, I think it was. I hear it's going on 5 years ago now.
So you settled and farmed there?
Yes.
Initially?
Yeah. It was a very small farm, of course.
Yeah, but did you make your living from it?
Partly. To start with, but about the time we got into the Simmental cattle, the exotics were starting to lose their... We made a bit of money off of it.
Yeah.
You know? And then I went and got together with some three other guys in town here. We built houses for a while, did that. And Carol went to work. And she was a lab tech.
That was your wife?
Yeah.
And she's still alive?
Oh, yes.
Good.
She's still alive, and she's working in the lab, not the lab anymore, but in the medical clinic here in town.
Good. And is she younger than you are?
Considerably younger.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yes.
How old is she?
She's,
You're 89.
Yeah, and she's almost 20 years younger than I am.
Oh, that's great.
I robbed the cradle.
Well, then, but she's helped to keep, and you had two daughters?
Absolutely. She's been perfect.
Yeah. Two daughters, did you say?
Yeah, and a son later. The daughters were born in Saskatchewan, and our son was born in High River.
Now, where does aviation come into your life?
Well, the first thing I remember about aviation was sometime in the 30s, I was probably about 11 or 12 years old, this old biplane Rover Top, one of the Barnstormers, you know. And I thought, God, I've got to do that. I've got to do that.
Why?
It just was in my blood to get up there in the air with something like that. I don't know if that's a good explanation or not.
Did you ever catch up to the Barnstormer? Did he come down?
No way. I did go with another Barnstormer at another town along the Climax. I had a, affair there, and we went over, and I went up with sitting on them on my friend's lap, because they did it by the cent a pound thing, and it wouldn't take you if you were only, you had to have enough weight to make it pay. Yeah.
So how much did you pay? Was it you and a buddy?
Yeah, yeah.
How much did you pay?
I forget what I weighed at that time. I think it totaled up something like $300 or something like that.
Woo!
No, that one, that's not right.
No.
300 pounds at a...
At a penny a pound would be, yeah, $30.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Get my arithmetic right.
Good. And this, so, do you remember the friend's name?
Oh, yeah. Gerald Wells, yeah. We were good buddies, yeah.
And you just, and so you went at Climax. You, yep, went up. What year would that,
yeah,
have been?
Yeah, they had a field there, a pasture field they used for the runway. And yeah, anyway, he took us up for 10 minutes maybe or something like that.
Do you remember his name?
No, I've lost all recollection of that.
But he was just a barnstormer.
Yeah, yeah.
And did he do bush flying or what?
He was a... the airplane he had was a bi-wing. I think it could have been an old Jenny or something like that. That I don't know either. And I don't know what the thing it was that flew over me earlier on, you know.
But it was a biplane.
Yeah, oh yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. They came down in that country periodically and went from town to town.
Right, making money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't know what they made. But
what did it look like when you looked down out of on your friend's lap?
Oh, it was thrilling. Yeah. Yeah.
What time of year was it?
It was done in the summertime, fair time, probably in July or thereabouts.
Oh, so maybe that's why he was there, if it was the fair.
Well, that's why he was there.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, the way I said that. It was a fair there, and that's where they went if there was a landing field close in and things right. like that.
So it was the Climax Fall Fair?
How was that again?
Was it the Climax Fall Fair?
Yes, it was, yeah. Or summer fair, late summer fair, whatever.
Yeah. And you were how old?
Oh, what would I have been? I forget exactly what year it was, but it was in, I guess, about in 37 or 38, so that would make, 38, I guess, probably. Like, you don't take, just the days and the years don't stay with you from something like that, you know, it was something that happened. And,
right, but it made an impression.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And you never forgot it?
Oh, no, no, no. Well, once I'd been up in the air like that and was on my mind periodically that I'm going to do that someday. I was 30 years old before I got to do it. But
took a few years.
Yeah. Well, I got out of high school and I had a job on the secondary highway that ran by, right by our farm.
Doing what?
And running a motor grader, a small motor grader. And that was just in 49. And then I went farming after that, out of that. I didn't do that, I just did that the one year.
And then when did you come back to flying? And how?
Well, we finally started building a farm up. My dad was still quite viable. We farmed together and I did a lot, most of the work. And he died in 1957. And it suddenly struck me, you know, life is short. And I got thinking, if I'm ever going to do the flying thing, I've got to do it now. And so that fall, I broke the news to my mother. I went to Regina and learned to fly. And that was in the fall of the year, fairly late, in the first part of November. And I was there for a week, I guess. I had 10 hours in. And there was a big storm blew up at home, and we still had cattle and stuff like, and they were in up here for a pasture, and so I had to break off and go home, and I was hoping the weather would have lasted. Anyway, I didn't get back till the next year, but I sold it the first day I went back. I thought about it all winter, you know.
What were you flying when doing your lessons?
Hey, they were Cessna 140s and 120s, yeah.
Mono wing?
High wing model, two-place airplanes, yeah.
Two-place,
yeah, you know.
Oh, two engines?
No.
No, two-seater.
Two-seater.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but a single engine in the nose.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. What did it feel like to solo?
Well, it was thrilling. But I kept looking at that seat when I went out to the runway, you know, and there's nobody there. I got to do this all right. Like they told me when I left in the fall before that I was about ready to solo. You know, I probably would have soloed the next day, but I had to go. And anyway, I went up and around and back down again, and airplane was a little lighter because it was just me in it and performed like crazy.
Do you remember your instructor?
Yes, I always have trouble with that, remembering his name. It's in my logbook. He's a French, kind of a French name. Maybe I'll think of it later.
Okay.
Yeah.
But it felt like it was great fun.
Yes, oh yeah.
So you were hooked.
I was hooked before that.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So, the flying was really just kind of a hobby.
In a way.
Yeah.
Although I did use it on the farm.
To do what?
I bought an airplane the following year through the flying club in Regina. The head instructor there, he built an airplane a bit, so I bought an old Ronca Chief. The old time builder, you know, and
what's a time builder?
Well, to build up your hours for your logbook, you know, and they're slow, and it takes twice as long to go there as it would with something else. So, anyway, I bought that, and by this time we had acquired a piece of irrigation at Valmarie, and you're aware of Valmarie, and it was upstream. They had a second dam there. And farmers could get 40 acres for a sure hay crop, like, because the whole area below that, of course, was dry farming. And we got that, and I used the airplane to, it was about a 30-minute or 35-minute drive to drive down there, because it was through a pasture and rough roads and whatever, and I could fly there in 10 minutes. So I started, I left the longest irrigation strip, and I go down, make another irrigation set, go home and summer fall or whatever I was doing it, and probably go down at night and change the set again. So
you would fly from your farm, home.
I had made a runway by that time.
Okay.
A grass runway, and yeah.
Off grass, or
it was a grass runway.
Yeah. Yeah. And that you'd go from your home quarter.
Right.
To the irrigation place.
Yeah.
And what do you mean you were setting the irrigation? Were you drawing water from the dam?
No, they turned the water into your head ditch, and all these strips are below it.
Right.
They one after the other. And you threw a canvas dam in the water, and then you mudded it in kind of and stuff. So that when the water hit it and built up, it was like a dam.
And then And so you were using the water that was dammed there to water the ground.
And then we'd cut a hole in the ditch there and let it out onto the, let it run out onto the particular strip.
Oh, okay.
It was mudding around, you know. You were in rubber boots and mosquitoes and everything else.
But you would fly the 10 minutes to that location.
That's right. Yeah.
To do this work.
Yeah.
And what were you growing in there?
It was alfalfa hay and whatever mainly. Yeah.
Okay. And so the plane, the Ronca, you said?
The old Ronca.
Yeah. Ronca.
Ronca Chief, yeah.
Yeah, and it got you there and back. And how long did you do that?
Did that for, I guess, maybe 4 years. I think it was the fourth. And that's where I had my only accident. It wasn't terribly serious, but it was in a way. But I was summer followed all day, dirt in the eyes, and I'd been courting my wife in swift current at night before. And I crawled in the airplane with dust in the eyes and went down, and I had I wasn't using quite the longest strip. I had watered it if I'd left the next one, and I come in to land, and like when you're learning to fly, the instructor says if you're in doubt that you're going to land, if you're too far in, go around, go around, go around. And this little voice was saying, Bob, go around, go around, go around, and I ignored it. And I landed quite far into the strip, and the head ditch was coming up, and I almost had it stopped. And they had heel brakes, and my foot slipped off the one off of the left brake, and it just turned sideways, almost stopped. And one wheel went into a lateral. They were lower ditches, but and the prop hit that and knocked the end off a prop, and there I was. Anyway, the water master come along and he took me home. The half hour drive back and down there and back.
What's a water master?
The irrigation master, I guess. Yeah, the guy in charge of the water. And
but that was your land you were irrigating.
Oh, yes,
yeah?
We owned it. Bought it. We bought it on a time thing to start with.
So the water master was a guy you'd hired to work to do the work.
He looked after the whole thing. He allotted the water to you when you were ready, and your neighbor next, and things like that.
And that was the PFRA that did that.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay, I got it.
Yeah, it was all PFRA.
So you were getting too tired from going down to visit your girlfriend in Swift Current.
Well, it was a combination of things.
Right. But so you didn't fly to Swift Current, did you?
No, I drove.
To see her? Okay.
Because I came back at 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that.
Right, you were tired.
Yeah.
And then flying back and forth. How many trips would you have done the day you had your accident?
I was there in the morning.
Yeah.
Because I made a set, and then this is the one after I'd summer followed all day and whatever, you know, that's when I made the error.
And how'd they get the plane out of there?
Well, I phoned Smith Airways in Swift Current. I got to know Al Smith and some of his guys, and I told him what I'd done. And he said, we'll come down in the morning with a prop. And it had bent the undercarriage, like the undercarriage, you know, there were all kind of a V like that and the axle on it, and it was covered with fabric, and it had bent the one piece. So Al came down there with another guy, and they landed on one of the roads along the, and walked over with a prop, and you know, they put the prop on, and he dragged a piece of 2x4 out of his airplane and strapped it on some hay wire and put it against this bent. It wasn't bent much, but it certainly needed some reinforcing. And then he took off and took it to Swift Current and fixed it.
So he flew it, did he?
Oh yeah, he flew it back.
He flew it back.
And his father pilot went took their airplane back.
Oh, so that the two of you were able to fly together then? So he fixed it, and then the two of you flew in the Aranca?
No, I went home with my truck. I'd got a ride home,
right.
And I had to come down the next day and meet with him.
Were you injured? When it flipped
like that? It was a non-accident that way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just all about stopped. If I hadn't hit, my foot hadn't slipped off the brake.
Yeah, and maybe if you'd gone around, you'd have found another spot to land?
No, I would have landed closer to the end. The thing was, I was a little high, and so I landed probably a quarter of the way into it, and that was no good on that strip.
Because you went too far.
Yeah.
Now, when this whole business with the Lancaster started, do you remember all of that?
I remember a lot of it, yeah. Like when we moved to Nanton, that was one of the attractions, the old airplane. The old Lancaster sitting outside looking pretty terrible, and I thought, well, I'll get involved with that. But I did brought my last airplane with me at that time.
Which was?
And it was a Piper Tri-Pacer. Now, it was one of the last ones built, about a 68 model. And I made a runway in the hayfield out on the 90 acres out there.
Yeah.
And that's where I landed. And then I built a pole hanger for it and whatever.
But you saw that Lancaster and you immediately thought, I got to get involved?
Well, it wasn't a big thing, but it was like seeing that one in the 30s, that airplane going over it, you know. I should get involved with that. And so I did when I see it about, and let's see, we sold the airplane later on. We had two little girls and a boy. And when you wanted to go someplace, the airplane would handle it at that time. But generally, the weather was all fouled up. And then we built a house on the house that's there now, on the acreage, and bought one in town. And when we sold that, we took a motorhome on trade.
Right.
And every weekend, take a look at the airplane. And the weather was lousy. We go, and so we just the motorhome became the transportation for the family. The airplane sat there for another couple of years, think the last year I flew it, it only had 10 hours on it.
Yeah. So your flying time came over to was invested here instead.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What were some of the first things you did when you started volunteering? What were you doing?
Oh, I helped, I think, with a lot of it, and cleaning it up was the first thing.
The Lancaster.
Yeah, because it had been all, you know, the birds had got in it, and people had vandalized it, and we had a really good group, you know, at the start there.
Who was there those years? Who do you remember in those first few years?
Well, there's only the three of us left right now. That's Dan Fox and Dave Burrell and myself, and Rob Peterson came along a little later, and of course George White and Howie Armstrong, who had brought the airplane there to start, they were still alive.
Right.
They were a big part of it, yeah, for sure.
Did you see the plane being brought in?
No. That had happened in 1960.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, they...
So what was your specialty in the cleanup of the Lank?
Oh, I think we just did everything. Right? Every one of us did something different. Some of the guys went into the engines and took the valve covers off and to see what kind of shape they were in and whatever. But I didn't have much to do with that, although I had some experience with taking pots off of radial engines and stuff, you know.
Right.
But that's a whole different ballgame. I've done some of that kind of work.
Some of the air mechanics, you mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But once the Lank was more or less cleaned up and you started to do the rebuild and so on, yeah, where did you fit into that mix of work?
Every place.
What was your favorite? What'd you like to do the best?
Good question. Some of the stuff that I'd done that I did later on, like acquiring more airplanes once we got the first building out here.
Yeah.
That was kind of, because I had so many contacts from flying farmers and whatever, you know, that working on the airplane, just I didn't mind any kind of mechanics, yeah.
Did you find yourself gravitating here more and more often?
Yeah. My wife used to give me, and still does give me a bad time, I'm here too much, but but I am trying to reason myself out. At my age, somebody's got to do the things I do, you know, and it's time for that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What are some of the interesting pieces that you picked up from flying farmers?
Oh, you mean like the airplanes and whatever? Yeah.
Yeah, you were out searching for parts?
Well, the first thing we had, when we got the building, got the Lank inside on a gravel floor and nothing else, we had one old Anson carcass that we brought up and put with it. And that was one of the things we did in 87 and 88. We hauled up 20 old carcasses, Anson carcasses.
20?
Yeah, all together.
From where?
We went out, we got the one, and then we decided it's missing a whole bunch of parts. And then we'd look on some, and they came off of a farmer's backyard. You could buy them after the war for anywhere from 50 to 100 bucks with the wings dropped off. And so we got looking at them. One would have a couple of things or three on it, and another one would have about six things we needed. And the next one over here, it had something altogether different. So we just went around, and the farmers let us pick them up. And
how far did you go to find them?
We went from High River to Pincher Creek.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And you brought back how many?
20, it was 22.
Carcasses.
Carcasses, essentially. God. Some of them had more and some of them had less.
Wow.
Yeah. Farmers bought them, you know, they'd used the wheels and the tires off of them. They used the hydraulics out of the Mark II Hansons and things like that,
yeah.
The wiring.
Yeah.
But really the rest of it, well, some farmers, I know there was one, he had his kids take everything apart and salvage all the bolts, and all that was left was a skinny frame.
So you were the scavenger?
There were other scavengers too. But
The scrounger.
But the fact that I knew flying farmers. Well, the first airplane we got from out of Saskatchewan was the Cornell that's in the back. It's on display out here, but the wings are against the wall. It hasn't been restored yet.
Yeah.
And that was a fellow that I knew quite well, a crotchety old guy that flew. And when you got to know him, he'd give you the shirt off his back.
But, yeah.
We had the Anson in there, the old carcass, and the Lank. And I kept thinking, oh, he used to have two of those Cornells, which he did. And so I wrote him a letter, and I said, you know, we're putting this museum together, and we wondered if you had a few parts of a Cornell, like a Collings, maybe an old engine or something.
Right.
And you'd like to... My boy, I think I'm going to bore you.
Not at all. I was just checking a note on something that you said.
Oh,
yeah. Because I wrote down some stuff before.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Anyway, yeah, Ernie Oakman was his name, and Cratchety as could be, you know.
Oakman?
I wrote him this letter,
yeah.
And I got an answer back. He said, I don't think you'd want this airplane. Like, he's talking about the whole Cornell that he's restoring or started. And so I, good God, he wants, he said, I wonder. Of course, we had hardly any money at that time. I think we had about $3,000 in the bank, and he'll want $2,500 for it at least or something. And so I phoned him, and I said, "Did you mean the whole airplane?" Yeah, he said, "I don't think I'm never going to finish it." He said, "You can have it." And I said, "What would you want for it, or me?" And he said, "Nothing. Hey, nothing. Yeah, come and look at it first, and we'll talk about it." And I said, "Well, we decided that we'd go to $2,000. It would leave us with hardly any money, but it's another airplane, and it's complete, even though it needs restoration." So I I said, "Would you take $2,000 for it?" "Oh, I don't need anything like that," he said. And hell, I got me out of that. And I said, "Well, I tried $1,000," and he said, no, I don't need that." He said, "Come and see it, and we'll talk about it." And anyway, when we got there, we flew over. John Green was another of the locals here, the flying farmer that flew us over there, and he was part of the board of directors and whatever. And we went out there, and all he wanted was enough money, because his sump pump in his well was gone, and he wanted to buy a new sump pump, and I think it was about $250 or something. Well, we couldn't steal, that's stealing it from him. So we were by that time, we were a registered charity, you know, we could give tax receipts. So we gave his son a tax receipt for the rest of it. And then the day we went to load it, we had Mullen Trucking haul a big part of it. We hauled some of it ourselves, and they were really good to us too. They hauled a lot of our stuff.
What was the name of the company?
Mullen Trucking. They're just up the road here from us. They're an international trucking firm across North America.
Mullin or A-N?
A-N, yeah. Mullen.
Mullen.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
where was Ernie's place?
It was north of Swift Current at Stewart Valley.
And so you rolled it back from there?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So that was a bit of a prize.
Yes, it was for sure. But when we went to collect the airplane, he said, when he got it all loaded up, he said, "Bob, come with me." And we went back to this granary, and he opened it up, and here's this Fleet Fawn. We didn't know what it was. We thought it was a Fleet Finch at that time. And the wings are all there, and everything's there. Some of the fabric was off some of the wings, and one of the wings, the upper wing, had been out in the yard, I guess, and a horse got in it and trampled a bunch of it, but it was still there, you know. And he said, "Yeah, I don't know about this." He said, "I think I'm still going to restore this, but I want you to see it anyway." And I kept thinking about that. And 2 years later, he sent me a letter, and he said, "You know, if you want that fawn, why, you can have it, but I want $2,500 for it." Well, by that time we had some money, and so we picked that up. Yeah.
Neat. That's great.
And it was our first restoration too, by the way.
The fawn.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that must make you feel pretty happy, that proud that you've been able to use your contacts to do that.
Yeah. No, it was fun doing that. Yeah.
When did you get into flying farmers?
Oh, I joined the Flying Farmers in 19, I learned to fly in 57, 58.
Yep.
So I joined the Flying Farmers that winter, the winter of, what would have been 89, I guess, yeah. And I...
59.
59, yep. Yes. And my words come out wrong sometimes.
Oh, you're doing fine.
Yeah.
And is it still? Are you still a member?
No, actually, we were a member for 22 years there, and I brought the airplane here, and I was a member of Alberta for about for 4 years or so. And when we sold the airplane, it was kind of over with, you know. And I think I was a member for an extra year there, but
Right.
that's all.
And what is your connect? You didn't go to war. You never flew in military
No,
aircraft,
no.
but you've
No.
got this extraordinary love affair for military planes.
Oh yeah,
Why?
it's a vintage airplane. It's
Yeah.
and well, actually, I got out of school in 1945, just as the war ended, you know, and out of high school, and I was thinking seriously I would join the RCAF. It looked like the war was going to be over, but I was an only son, and my dad was getting up in years, and so I graduated toward the farm.
But where does the connection in your gut come from for military planes like the Lancaster and the Fawn and the
It's
Ansons?
just another step greater than, or just an airplane, just an ordinary civilian airplane, I think.
Yeah.
No, I've never been asked that question before, but I got right into it. I'm very involved with the, and the other thing is we all did. All we knew that was one of the four engine bombers of World War II when we started working on it, and didn't realize its history. And then we started looking into it. Dave especially, you know, we delved in. This is a piece of history. And then we found out there was only about 18, 17 or 18 of them left in the world. We got this in a little town, prairie town in Alberta. Yeah, that's almost impossible, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's where the enthusiasm really started. But
Did you know, and you know that I'm working on the Dam Buster story. How much did you know those stories as a young man learning how to fly and getting interested in aviation? Did any of those stories click in your head when you suddenly realized what you guys were doing? In terms of their
I'm
meaning,
sure
their
over the years
significance?
I'd read some of it, but the enthusiasm was there, but nothing like it was once you had one of the actual bombers right in front of you know.
Did you do some little bit of studying to know more about what those planes did?
Yeah. Once we started on that, yeah. I used to be able to. I used to do tours and stuff. I don't much anymore, but and I had a lot of the specs in my head. Still do have some of them. Yeah.
Right. And how does the Dam Busters raid resonate for you?
Oh, it's great, but and only because of my involvement here and the progression we with our that our I guess that's the way to say it of our museum toward that. And then when Terry Tarum's relatives brought his medals over here. Man, that brought that to life, yes.
Can describe what happened. I wasn't. I'm not. I know it happened, but I wasn't aware of how.
Yeah. Oh, that's my old memory. Anyway, it was a cousin, I think, from over at Milo that actually came to us to start with, and she said we had all his, and we knew his story by that time, you know.
Yeah.
And she said, well, we've got his medals and all
Well,
this
that was
and
his
that.
cousin Eleanor.
That's right,
Yeah.
yeah, that's right, yeah. Yeah.
But describe what that was like when that on that day. What happened?
Well, they brought this stuff over, and these medals are just something else again. And we had to display them, which we do. But we can't just put them out in a, you know, in a display case. Somebody could break the glass, and they're a piece of history that somebody would give a lot of money for. So we got our local welder to do some welding and put a frame on the outside of it, and they're mounted up on a piece of plexiglass that's that thick,
But a half an inch
and they're
stick.
bolted into the wall. It hasn't moved since we put it there.
But was it a pretty exciting ceremony that the handover? Were you here then, Carl?
No, that was before my time.
Yeah.
He's too young for that.
Do you need something?
Bless you, Bob.
Do you need anything?
No, I just
Okay.
was going to check. You're making progress?
Yeah, absolutely. What
Are you
time's the
going to stay
do?
another day, or what do
I'm
you
going to stay
figure?
over tonight and then leave tomorrow. I'm going to talk to John Walker up in Calgary tomorrow.
Okay, we'll feed you enough chicken wings so you'll have feathers by tomorrow morning.
What time do you gather over there?
5:30.
5:30.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
We'll be out of here shortly.
So that day was pretty special. You were in the
It was
audience, or?
special, but it was not really a. a big, like it was, I think most of our directors were there, if, as I remember, but it wasn't something that was public or anything. And I guess there were a few visitors around.
Right.
They brought this in and we took them and they signed the gift form for it. And we went through everything and admired the...
Yeah. But that kind of focused everything on the Dam Busters.
Oh, it did, for sure. To have somebody that, you know, that was Gibson's navigator, you know, that had been born 40 or 50 miles away from here, you know, hey, and to have his medals and whatever, yeah, oh, that's a story that I really like, all right. I've
never Why? Heard. Why is it so special?
I think partly because of the fact that there's something, some of the relatives were here, his memorabilia, the medals, it all kind of, and it was the first thing that we had any that was quite like that too, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know, everything was special in a way.
Yeah. But now you also took care of the newsletter.
I have done the newsletter since 87, I guess, first one that went out.
Wow. Why? What gravitated you to that?
I always interested in writing. And I used to get political over in Saskatchewan, and I used to write to the newspapers, and I wrote articles for other things too, and in my simple form. And when I came to Nanton, the Maynards, husband and wife, had just taken over the newspaper. Got to know them. I used to run a column in the newspaper there. Yeah.
What was it called?
Oh, I forget what it was. It was just Evans's Thoughts or something like that. I'm not sure if it, what heading they had on. But I got into politics and religion, and I put something controversial in there. And we had this other guy who wrote to the paper all the time too, and still does occasionally. And he was left of center where you wouldn't believe, you know. And he'd try to counter it, and then I'd go back on him. And, well, a lot of the people liked that, you know.
So you had a kind of a conservative slant.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
He had kind of a liberal slant.
Yeah, well, he would be on liberalism.
But your column was sort of a comment.
Yeah.
You did comments.
And I also I wrote about other things as well. Yeah.
Where did that writing come from?
I don't know. I liked to write in school.
Did you?
Yeah. Yeah. That part of my studies, I guess, was... And of course, I've always had an interest in community and stuff like that that seems to be built in me somehow.
And so when did you start your column for the Nanton News?
Shortly after we came here. We came in 75. I think I started doing that in about 79 or 80.
Yeah?
I did save some of my columns at one time, but I'm not even sure where they are now.
I'd like to see one or two. If you ever come across one and you could spare it, send it to me.
Yeah, okay.
I'd love to see it. Yeah. Did you ever write about the museum?
Oh, yes, I've done that, yes. And I did a lot of correspondence, too. Well, they finally dubbed me with the curator thing, you know.
Yes.
Partly because I was probably one of the guys that had actually had an engine part, aircraft engine, at least the pots off of it, knew what it, how it went together and thing at that time. And so, I had been on my mind I'd like to do that anyway, and then we got into the chasing airplanes and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Could you ever have imagined in your wildest dreams when you saw that Lancaster sitting out by the highway that this would be the result all these years later?
No. I don't think any one of us realized where it was going, except when we, because the idea was the town wanted it cleaned up and made into a better tourist attraction. And we started with that idea. We're going to clean it all up. We're going to fix the fence, and we're going to put some ladders there and whatever, and let people in it once in a while. And then we got reading about what this thing had done during the war, what that type had. And God, we got to do more on this. And then we took a good look at it, and it was in pretty good shape, other than the instruments are all tore out of it, but that's something you can put back.
So. Yeah.
And the plexiglass, of course, was all broken out. And then we got thinking, maybe it could be flown. We canceled that after a while. There's just no way we're going to afford anyway to restore that. We were looking at that time about $8 million to put it in the air. But we've been in contact with Whoops, pardon me, I have my phone here. Hello, Bob speaking. Oh, okay, good. I'll pick it up later. Thank you. Okay, bye-bye. My hearing aids.
They worked like a dam.
Yeah, it works good. Yeah.
That's great.
I don't hear very well without them at all.
Yeah, am I speaking loudly enough?
Oh, you're. Okay. Yeah, I can control your but the you're audio. Fine.
Good.
You're perfect, yeah.
Good.
And your voice is good, too.
Thank you.
So
you were talking about the correspondence you used to do for the museum, doing a lot of what as the curator.
Yeah.
Did you do a lot of campaigning and all that sort of stuff, or just seeking out more parts?
More, partly that.
Yeah.
And contacting people I knew that might know where there was some or something like that.
What was the biggest discovery after as you were kind of seeking and looking for things?
Well, the last thing we got, I guess, was the Bolingbroke that's sitting out there, and it belonged to Harry Werrett, and he collected airplanes after the war and surplus airplanes. He had a couple of Harvards, he had Tiger Moths, he had that Bolingbroke sitting out in his yard, and he had, I forget all he had. Oh, he had a Lysander, and I knew him because he was a flying farmer again.
Right. Werrick?
Where at?
How do you spell it?
W-H-E, the word where.
Yeah, W-H-E-R-E.
Yeah.
A-T-T?
A-T, just T-A-T.
One T.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he's gone now, but most of his airplanes went someplace else.
Yeah. What was the best, the wildest, most exciting discovery in terms of getting parts for the Lancaster? What was the most exciting one to find?
Well, you know, a lot of the Lancaster parts came from a young fellow, David Spakes is the dad. Yeah. Oh, I should, my brain, every now and again.
You're doing pretty good as far as I can see. But his name was Spinks?
Yeah, Jonathan Spinks.
There you go.
Yeah, and he started looking for old parts of Ireland, of Lancaster for a long time. Way back when he was still in school, his dad and him went fishing one day, and they went by this farm where this Lancaster was still sitting in the backyard. And from then on, he never went fishing again. They looked for airplanes.
Wow.
And he was a good friend of Richard. I know you've met Richard DeBoer.
Yeah.
Yeah. They partnered up, and they were all over the place. They picked up Bolingbrokes and sold them to people in the States. They gave them to museums, and then they got involved with us. Jonathan actually was going to try and buy the Lancaster at one time. He found out that wasn't for sale, so he started picking up pieces and giving them to us. No, he was a real resource.
Great.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, well, he was a good.
You guys have a lot of fun when you get together in the workshop on Tuesday nights.
Oh yeah, we have fun.
What do you do when you're working on something?
Well, right now I'm working on that, or have been. Trying to work on that cabin section of the Cessna crane that we talked about this morning.
Yeah.
Myself and another young guy, I've just finished putting, we restored all the wood and stuff in it, and the wooden framework, and then we've got the fabric on it. We're putting it back the way it would have been originally, as close as we can. And so we've got the fabric onto the stage where we're going to start now with spraying on it, and of course our paint booth is a temporary thing. I don't know whether you've been around.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've seen it then?
Yeah.
Yeah. And we've done some painting before. Well, Greg Morrison, our AME volunteer, he painted the wings on the Tiger Moth that's on display right now.
Yeah.
He did all that work. We hired him to do it, man. He got paid for it. But he did all the spraying back there with two little bloody fans that I got out of the hardware store. And then we get reading about it, and we're thinking, they're not explosion-proof. When you need for a paint booth, you need fans that have explosion-proof motors on them. So we're not going to do that. He did all those wings, and he never said anything about it. And he did a beautiful job, you know.
What's you said he's with AME. What's that?
Aircraft, Yeah, aircraft mechanical engineer. Yeah. Yeah, I gotta hesitate on things like
that. No, that's okay. So and what? So Tuesday nights are like a they're set in your calendar. You do that every week.
Yeah.
When did those start?
Oh, quite a while ago. Well, when we first started, before we had the building, and even after we had the building, we had a workshop on the south side of town that some people they let us have it. They didn't rent it to us. They just told us you can have the top half of it, the rest of it was storage. And so we restored a whole bunch of stuff there.
Oh, neat.
Radial engines and stuff like that for the ants. Yeah. But that's not answering your question.
So I think I asked when the Tuesday night started.
Yeah. Well, the Tuesday night was even down there to a point, but we did it other days too, and Saturdays. And Tuesday night right now has been, oh God, it's been going for... It's been going for 20 years anyway.
Right.
Longer than that.
Right.
I can't answer your question right off.
But it sounds like you guys have more fun than you'd get any work done.
No, we do get work done, but we always have the social hour with some of the guys with their beer and some of the rest of us with I drink a beer occasionally, but not. The last few years we've had one of our volunteers from Calgary, his wife bakes cookies and brings them in for the luncheon afterwards.
Who's that? Who does the cookies? Whose wife does the cookies?
Terry Tarum is his name. Not Terry Tarum. Terry Tarum isn't born.
Yeah. He was the navigator.
Yeah, that's right. Terry. Right on the tip of my tongue.
Anyway.
He works in a workshop.
Right.
And a lot of the stuff in the workshop, like the bench that the chop saw is on and things like that, he's built all that for us. And
If you were to think about all the volunteer hours you've put into this place.
Oh, yeah.
How many would that be?
Oh, monstrous. Yeah.
Years of volunteer hours.
Yeah, I have no idea. I think we tried to keep record of people's hours for a couple of 3 years there, but that's fallen by the wayside right now.
Why?
Because I couldn't do it anymore. I could have, but I kept missing it. You know, and unless you're going to do it all, we need to redo that because lots of grants. Call for it. We do have some past records up till about 3 years ago, I guess. And I kept missing. I missed a few times in there. Didn't know who was there. Nobody knew. And what we need to do is put in a system where, when they come to work, they just sign their name in at such and such a time, and we can convert it afterwards. Yeah.
If the men who died or the men who survived the war, in either case, knew that this museum might be put together in tribute to them, what do you think they would think?
I think they would have liked the idea, probably. Yeah, they would have thought that they need more people to tell the upcoming generations what happened. And we are part of that for sure, and we're a big part of it now.
Do you think some of them might even have thought that what they did in their service in the war might have been forgotten?
I think that's possible too. Yeah. In fact, I have talked to some over the years that, and some of them, in so many words, would say, it's nice that somebody's kind of remembering what we did and making the population aware of it. But
did any of them ever express a fear that they might be forgotten to you?
Not really, not in so many words, but possibly in the way they spoke, yes, yeah. But most of them were just glad to have survived it, and looking back on it, of course, they realized what they'd done, and they realized that the history books weren't looking after that, too. We've had lots of them come in, they don't even tell about it in schools anymore, they'd say, and things like that,
So then, in a way, they were fearing being forgotten.
I guess, yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Did any one of the veterans you've met over the years leave a deep impression on you?
Several of them, but one in particular.
Who?
His name was Al Hymers. And he was toward the end of the war, and I guess in 44 sometime. And he was a big man, and they were getting short of rear gunners, and he became a rear gunner. And, you know, that you know how small that turret is back there. Mostly they wanted guys like my size or thereabouts. Anyway, he got in that, and I forget whether it was, which trip it was it was on, but anyway, they were hit, and he had to bail out. And the fuselage was on fire, the airplane was on fire, and they'd been told to bail out. Well, he had a seat pack by that time. You know, most of the tail gunners, you know, they had to get out of the turret, put the parachute was hanging there to one side, they had to put it on, snap it on, and then get back in the turret if they couldn't get out the door, and the fire was right up to this door. Anyway, he had a seat pack. So he turned it sideways, opened the doors, and fell all backwards, forgot to take his oxygen connection and his radio connection on this. They were told to take that off because you could break your neck as you went out. That just pulled off of there. And his feet were so big that he had to put his boots in when he got in the turret. And so when he exited the turret, his boots stayed there, and he landed in 10 inches of snow. And we have a we recorded him. He's got a. I did the asking the questions, you know, and I don't know if you're good at it, but he left a good impression of it. Yeah, but he landed in 10 inches of snow, and the parachute was dragging him, and the mid upper gunner, he had got out and out too, and he was right there. He'd let go his parachute go, and he was really badly burned. But he laid on Al's parachute, and they got it stopped. And of course, Al was going to put some gentian violin stuff on his. It was all burnt all over the place. And I didn't have nothing that. I'm going over to that farmhouse over the hill. And Al said, I'm going the other way. And I think he took a piece of his parachute somehow and wrapped around his feet. But so he wandered around for several days. But after this guy went over the hill and he went the other direction, he heard this shot, and at the time he didn't think much of it. Somebody's out, somebody, just one shot. And after the war, he went back to see what if this guy had survived, and I found out he hadn't, of course. But the German records had shown that there was only one man missing out of that airplane. They'd found all the rest of the crew in the crash, when it crashed, like. And they couldn't have, because he wasn't in there. So they falsified those records. And Al was always really disturbed about that they were allowed to get away with that, because it didn't happen that way.
The Germans said that everybody had died in the crash.
With the exception of Val himself.
Yeah.
Just the one guy. Yeah.
And in fact, five had died in the crash and one was shot.
That's right, yeah.
And that story has left an impression on you.
Oh, yeah. And then he went on, too, of course. You know, he...
Where had he landed? Where had they crashed?
That I don't have in my...
In Holland, was it? Or Germany?
It was in Germany, I believe, near the Black Forest.
So he was captured then?
You know, I don't have that in my head.
No? So Al was captured?
No. Well, he went for 10 days, and he dug... roots out of gardens and stuff like that out of the snow, but he finally got to the point he finally decided he went up to another farmhouse, and who opened the door there but the Gestapo too, but they didn't shoot him, but they of course they took him, and they quizzed him for several days, you know, he ended up in Stalingrad number 3, yeah. And then he was on the Long March.
Yep.
He was 180 pounds when he was shot down, and when he was finally in the camp that they ended up at, When it was overrun by the Americans, he weighed 100 pounds.
And where was he from?
He was from Bruderheim, Alberta, up by Edmonton.
Yeah. And he you connected with him here?
Yeah. He, the first time he came in, I got talking to him and talked about the Lank a bit. And he just gave me the bare bones. Yeah, he said, I flew in them. I was in the tail turret. And I bailed out and was in a prisoner of war camp and didn't really want to talk about it. He came again the next year. You could see what we were trying to do, you know, trying to show the rest of the populace what really happened back then. And he talked a little more. And I said something to he gave me a little more of the story. And he, I said, you know, you should tape that story. We should tape it for you. I don't want to do that. So he, third time he come, I said something to him again, and he kind of retold the story and added a few things to it. And so, you know, we've got a video machine here, a video camera, and we'd sure like to record your story. It's worth recording for history. So I suppose you could do that, yeah. So we got him in the library here and talked to him for, I forget how long it is, I think it's about a half an hour. And he went through the whole thing again. And he, when he told it the last time, he kind of missed some things, trying to get through, I think. And we talked about it afterwards, things he'd said the other 2 years, you know, like, and the one story he missed was, when on the long march, they were strafed by American P-51s or something. Well, not P-51s, whatever it was. Of course, everybody's in the ditch, including the guards, you know. And he had a buddy with him there, and they were laying there in the ditch, and the buddy said something about, you know, we should get away. And this voice behind him in German said, "No, you don't." And it was the guards, which they'd got along pretty good with, you know.
Yeah,
they were still on this, the guards were on this march too, you
That's
know.
That's right.
They got fed a lot better, I think. But anyway, they ended up in this other camp.
You really are a curator. Because in order for someone to feel comfortable enough with a stranger, such as Al did with you, to do that, that takes a lot of skill.
I have a way with people, some people, not everybody, but like some of them, you know, I don't have a trouble with at all. Others I can't, you know, they'll never talk to me, I don't think. But he's not the only one that's talked to me on occasion. No.
Any of the dam buster families and so on, have you interviewed any of them?
No, I've never really, I've met the ones that were here, you know, but Dave and Dave does a lot of that too, and he's anything that's recorded from them, he's taken care of that.
But you're a natural connector.
Yeah.
You connect. That's great.
Yeah,
that's a great skill.
Yeah, I guess
must be your upbringing from Brecon.
Yeah, well, my dad was easy with people too.
Was he?
Yeah, he. Our little town, of course, if strangers came in, everybody talked to them anyway, but my dad would start a conversation right away with them and find out who they were, where they were from, tell them about the town. And, yeah.
It's very prairie. It's a very prairie thing.
Yeah. Because back then, you know, in the 30s and 40s, people were more, they got together more and they, what should I say? It was a whole different society anyway, you know, they, like neighbors were neighbored with you and if you needed help, they helped you.
Yeah.
And a stranger on the street, you know, looking for somebody, you'd make sure he found them and things like that, which is an automatic. Nobody was a stranger.
Yeah. No. Or a veteran who doesn't want to talk.
Yes. Yeah, there was something about Al, I had a kind of a
Rapport
with him, that's the word. Yeah.
How do you spell his last name?
Hymers, H-Y-M-E-R-S, yeah.
Okay. What squadron was he with?
Can't tell.
I can find out.
Yeah, no, we have a record of him, yeah, for sure, yeah.
This has been great, Bob.
Yeah.
I appreciate this very much. it's nice to know, I'm getting to know more of what's gone into this place.
Yeah. It's, yeah, there's something about this thing, you know, like the hours and months and days that I put into this role. Hey, I don't regret one bit of it, you know.
No.
It's one of the best things I ever did in my life, yeah. Like, I got involved with politics and the Western Canada concept thing, you know, way back in the 80s.
I remember that.
Yeah. I got quite involved with that locally here and whatever. And with Gordon Kessler, who headed it, he was our rep. And I found out what politics was like. And when it was all over, of course, he lost, of course, you know. And I decided, hey, from now on, I'd already been doing some of it. My community and the people in this area, that's what I'm going to look after or do things for. I'm not going to... Politics, they can have it. It's a dirty, dirty game.
But part of that community is the military aviation community too, isn't
it? Oh, yes, for sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think, you know, the bunch of us have created something here that nobody had any idea we'd be doing what we're doing today. And here we are looking for some more room to put things, you know.
When you barely had room for the link.
Yeah, what time we got here?
It's time. I want to get back to my photocopy.
Yes, I've got to meet those people out here too.
Okay. So. But no, thank you. You're wonderful...